Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
No, they did know what they were doing. It's hard to know for sure how much palettes had changed, but they weren't just... There was sometimes you do get the feeling that they're just trying to throw sugar in everything, a little bit of it, because it's sugar. Mm-hmm. But sugar does work in cookery. It can enhance, you know, and we do it today with tomato sauces, a pinch of sugar, and you lift the whole thing.
Yeah.
And the same can happen with spices, you know, and that's what was interesting about that Anglo-Norman collection, that it does offer these little nuggets of information that, you know, you can improve a spice by adding a bit of sugar. It will bring out, or this spice will bring out the other spice as a counterpoint. And so there are people that understand about cookery. It's not all...
Yeah.
You know, it's not all mindless. Because in the past, the medieval cookery suffered with the reputation of just being mindless use of spices.
Hello. Welcome back to the Delicious Legacy Podcast. With me, Thomas Dinas. And to another archaeogastronomical adventure. This time, we are continuing our medieval adventure with an exciting interview with Dr. Christopher Monk, who's doing the Monk's Medieval Cuisine YouTube video channel and also writing a book about medieval cuisine. Here on this episode, he will tell us all about it and all about how to interpret and understand medieval recipes and medieval manuscripts and bring them to the modern kitchen. Enjoy! Hello, Dr. Monk. Welcome to the Delicious Legacy Podcast.
Oh, thank you so much for having me again.
Yes, indeed. This is the second time.
You're a sucker for punishment, aren't you?
Yeah, I think you're only the second guest that has been twice in the podcast now.
Right, okay. I'm privileged.
You are in the company of two.
I am genuinely privileged.
So am I. Thank you for joining me. And basically, so you are here to tell us a little bit about medieval food in general, but also some more specific stuff. But before we start, for people who don't follow you on your YouTube channel or on Twitter, who are you and what do you do?
Well, I'm Christopher Monk, and I am a food historian, or that's one of my hats, and I also work with manuscripts, and I work for myself, so I have a consultancy business where I deal and work with people in the heritage sector. One of my main clients is Rochester Cathedral, and I look at a lot of their manuscripts for them and offer public history interpretations of those. And the food history is more my project, as it were, so to speak. So I'm writing a book about Richard II's cookery treatise, and hopefully that will be published in not too long from now. So that's mainly what I'm up to at the moment. My website is modernmedievalcuisine.com, and I have a YouTube channel, Monk's Modern Medieval Cuisine, as well. And I produce videos based on manuscripts, medieval manuscripts, mostly from England, but also a few from France and further afield as well. And I recreate the recipes for a modern kitchen.
Great, fantastic.
That's why I call it modern medieval. So it's a kind of way of trying to bring the recipes up to date and make them of use to modern cooks.
Indeed, yes. Because obviously, when we're cooking some recipes that are almost 1,000 years old, things are very different.
Yes, yes. And you must find that even more because you go back even further than I do. So I tend to go back probably no earlier than the 13th century, generally speaking. But I think you've gone back further than that, haven't you?
I've tried a few things from 2,500 years ago.
It's quite a challenge, isn't it, recreating things? And even in sort of the medieval period and looking at the 13th, 14th, 15th centuries, there's still a lot of interpretation that's necessary in order to produce something that's edible. And it boils down to two things: being able to understand what the text is actually saying to me, and so being able to read the languages that they're written in, and then being able to draw on experience as someone that's cooked for quite a few decades, though not professionally. That's how I'm able to bring something that's worth tasting, I think, generally. Amidst
Brilliant.
The disasters from experimenting.
Yeah, well, yeah, they happen, these. What can we do? It's part of the whole experimentation, I guess. So, obviously, I've done a little bit of a research in the past few weeks, and I've released a few episodes about medieval European food and cuisine, and I've touched a lot of different areas, of course, very broadly with very broad strokes. But for you, you specialize a little bit more, and you've actually investigated a specific manuscript, which is the form of curry.
Yeah, yeah. And to be even more specific, I'm investigating a particular version of the form of curry that's based in a library that I live quite near, the Manchester John Rylands Library. It has a special collections library, and there is a particular manuscript, or I shall say in this case, it is actually a book, just devoted to the recipes from King Richard's treatise. Mm. And that's what I'm focusing on particularly because it's the oldest and probably the only one that actually dates back to Richard's time.
Yeah.
The other versions that survive, like the one in the Brit. Well, there's several in the British Library. There's one famous one that's a scroll roll form, and that's quite a few decades later when it was copied. So I'm looking at that. But I do look at, it's necessary, I find, to look at other culinary collections, whether they be English and therefore some that are either near contemporary or before and occasionally afterwards. Mm. But also I look at contemporary French manuscripts that are written in old French. And there's an Anglo-Norman collection, or a couple of Anglo-Norman collections that I also look at. And this is because they help sometimes in interpreting what I'm reading in Richard II's book, but also they feed into the commentary that appears in the book that I'm writing. So I'm able to sometimes explain how a particular recipe in Richard's cookery book, how that dish appeared prior to Richard's book, or indeed how it might have evolved in the century that followed. That isn't a big emphasis of the book, but it does feed into the commentary, and I think it is quite interesting to see how, looking either side of Richard's book, the decades before and the decades afterwards, how it can help sometimes interpret what I'm reading, but also it can help to see how recipes have evolved through two or three centuries.
Mm. So I guess my question would be, what are the challenges when you're reading a recipe from that era, and especially in the interpretation department, and how does this recipe evolve or has evolved from the decades prior to the decades after?
Well, let's first explain that the John Rylands copy of the form of curry and is written in mm-hmm. Middle English. So that's the English that's similar. Well, it's the same English that Chaucer would have been familiar with, because the book is contemporary with Chaucer's works.
Mm.
That English, though people generally might pick up the odd word here and there, it sounds quite different mostly to people when they listen to that compared to modern English. So I've got to be able to make sure that I'm aware of how the language works, the vocabulary. And then you have, on top of that, there's a specialist vocabulary with regard to cookery, certain cookery terminology. I've got to make sure I don't make assumptions about the words and what they actually mean. And sometimes there are false friends. There are words that have shifted in meaning.
Ooh, okay.
So you even things like a cookery term that appears quite frequently throughout the medieval period in English is the word to seethe. Things are seethed.
Mm.
And we don't really use that term. So it's how do I translate that? Does it mean boiled?
Mm-hmm.
Does it mean simmer? Does it just mean cooked? And so that's a particular challenge, because you don't want to be telling people to, cook something too vigorously if it's something that is better to be cooked on a gentle simmer, for example, or just at the boiling point rather than being vigorously boiled. So there's those kind of things that have to be worked out. Sometimes that's through, comparing the recipes within the cookery book itself and comparing it with other recipes that use these terms.
Mm.
So what I've done with everything in the form of curry is look at every single ingredient.
Wow.
And every piece of equipment that's mentioned and every cookery terminology that's referred to. And I've defined them all and I've put them into part of my book is going to include a comprehensive and encyclopedic glossary, and all of those things, ingredients, equipment, and the cookery terminology will be properly defined to the best of my research abilities. This was something I've been working on quite a lot, because the section of the book that's about translating the recipes into modern English and also setting out the Middle English edition of the text, that's more or less done. There's a bit of tweaking now and again when I realize I need to alter my understanding of something. But the section that's about the glossary has grown and grown and grown, and each entry is bigger. Mm. And I've still got quite a lot to do. So that takes quite a lot of time. And, it's sometimes, I think you speak about challenges, and I was thinking that sometimes it's just very simple things or things that we think are simple, an apple might be referred to, or a particular herb might be referred to. And we can make assumptions about things like that. Like I wrote several blog posts on parsley and the types of parsley that were probably available at the time. And, it's about establishing or trying as much as possible, bringing all the evidence together to understand when some of these plant ingredients, like the various herbs and apples and other fruits, it's about understanding whether they were native species to England, that is, or were they introduced, or had they been in England for some time and then essentially become as if they were native.
Yeah, naturalized.
Naturalized. That's it. I can't think of the word for a moment. And then it's looking at evidence for whether any of these plants were cultivated in gardens as well. There is some evidence, and there's been research done over the decades about English gardens. Mm. It's about trying to understand to what extent these things were grown. And I can't write everything down that I read about and all the details, but in the glossary, the entries are quite, they are fairly detailed. They're not the kind of entry you'd see in a normal glossary. And that's, to me, that I kind of like that work. I like trying to find out things and be sure as much as it is possible that I've got something right.
Yeah.
So that's become a challenge because it does take up quite a lot of time. And sometimes I can spend a day or more just on one thing, trying to work it out and
right.
going down rabbit holes
yeah.
and reading an article just to be sure that something I've got it correct.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, it makes sense. So I think your book is something we could talk a little bit about it. Can you tell us a little bit more about it?
To put it simply, I wanted to produce an up-to-date translation of form of curry. There are Form of Curry is the most famous English cookery book, though there are earlier collections of recipes, but this one is the most famous. And I wanted to base it just on the John Ryland's library copy. The reason for that is because the previous edition of the text, which was done in 1985, that contained more recipes in it than are actually in the John Ryland's. So there's extra recipes that have kind of been added on. And I like to view the John Ryland's book as an item in itself. It tells you in the introduction that there are these 194 dishes, and it gives a table for those 194 dishes, and it sticks to 194. But over the decades that passed, things, later versions of the form of curry, they started to have a few extra recipes coming in. So I wanted to go back to this particular one. I suppose it's because I've handled it and looked at it, and it's, you know, it's available in the town that I live in Manchester.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to make it, also translate it in a way that perhaps undoes a few of the mistakes that I sometimes see on the internet for translations of certain recipes, where it's not necessarily that the translation is completely wrong, but the interpretation of what they're reading isn't really what the language is saying. So that's kind of quite technical way of explaining it, but really I wanted to make the most famous English cookery book accessible to people, and to bring to it a level of research that I'm used to doing in, you know, previous academic work, but still trying to keep it accessible. So it's it will have an introduction explaining some of the background to the manuscript and the context of food at that time, and then it will have about 9 or 10 chapters that are split into food categories. So vegetables, nuts, meat, poultry, fish, pasta, pastry, and so on. And the recipes for each of those categories will appear both in Middle English, and then it'll be followed by a modern English translation, and then a commentary. And in the commentary, I'll be explaining things to do with that particular dish, where Richard may have eaten it somewhere that we know for sure that he ate it, because we've got copies of menus where he attended a feast, and or where it might appear in at a feast of one of his contemporaries, or perhaps just before. So sometimes we can see some of the recipes in form of curry appearing in his successor's coronation feast. So Henry IV, who usurped the throne, we've got his coronation feast. We've also got his marriage feast as well, and some of the recipes from Form of Curry are listed in there. So I might bring things like that into the commentary. I might explain something about what then the dish's name means, if we can do that, if it's possible to find that out. Each of those chapters, and then it will have also this comprehensive and encyclopedic glossary at the end as well. So it's turning out to be quite a big book, and I've got a publisher that's interested in it. But I'm actually, I'm not writing to a deadline. I'm writing to so that I can produce it first to the standard I want it to be at before I actually formally submit it.
Yeah, excellent. Yeah, so it's a big job. It's ambitious.
I'm trying to occasionally weave the odd bit of humour in there, because that's how I like to write, like that. You know, because sometimes, you know, there is humour that comes through to me anyway, when I'm looking at food and what it meant then and what it might mean today. Kind of excess, or the someone like a king of England, the kind of conspicuous consumption is the term that's used, sort of the extravagance of it all compared to what, you know, what we might have for tea or dinner.
To add to that, the recipes, the way you construct the recipes for the modern cook, will they be accessible to someone to cook them in their home now?
Yes. Yeah. What's being worked, I'm not actually going to do, they may or may not be included, a section of sampled recipes that I've worked on and experimented on, some of which may have already be out there through my videos and so forth. I might do that, but also what I will do is if there's any way of dropping, not dropping hints, but actually giving information in the commentary section about the best way to tackle this dish, then I'll put that in there. I mean, I won't have gone through all 194. That's something I don't have the time to do. But I have gone through quite a few of them. Yeah. And there are also a lot of directions that overlap between the recipes. So there are similarities between a number of the recipes. But yes, the idea is then that the book is useful for somebody doing academic research, but it's also useful for somebody that's replicating, reproducing, adapting the recipes, whether they be somebody that reenacts history or whether they're just someone that likes to cook things from previous centuries. There'll be information in the commentary that will actually bring the dish alive. They'll understand what the dish is, because sometimes it's not immediately obvious, and they'll have an idea how to go about doing it. And yeah, a few tips thrown in here and there.
Brilliant. So I guess that kind of brings us to my next question, which something that we can talk about a little bit, perhaps, about the Anglo-Norman language style of recipes. What's all that about?
Well, quite often you'll hear people say that the earliest English cookery book or cookery collection is a form of curry. It probably, you could make a case for saying it is the earliest book if you look at the John Ryland's copy, because there are earlier English recipes or recipes from England,
yeah,
that come before the form of curry, but they're kind of not in book form. They're a sort of part of a collection of all of miscellaneous texts, prose or verse. Nothing to do with cookery, but you'll find a few recipes stuck in there. And the Anglo-Norman collections, there are two of them, they are like that. They appear within collection of various texts. So both of those are actually found in the British Library. There's two different manuscripts. One's called Additional 32085, very sexy name, and the other one's Royal 12CXII, or Royal 12C7. I'm actually at the moment looking at one of these manuscripts for a video I'm producing, and it's for a particular recipe, and I'm looking at the manuscript. It's available digitized. It is written in Anglo-Norman French, so Anglo-Norman is a dialect, or the dialect of French, that evolved in England. So it is similar to Old French, and if you speak some modern French, you will pick up some of the sounds, that the spellings are quite different often and are not consistent. And these recipes were written in that language, and it's the language that evolved from about 1066, when the Normans conquered England, and it carried on for several hundred years and was kind of the language of the elite Anglo-Normans, the Normans that became English, as it were. And also it became a language that would have been used, I suppose, by English people that had survived the conquest, that wanted to get on in the world. They would have probably also have become familiar with the language too.
Yeah.
So that's what these collections are written in, and they are earlier. One of them dates to about the end of the 13th century, and the other one near the beginning of the 14th century. And most likely these are not brand new recipes, but they were recipes that were already being used in England, but this is how they've survived as collections. And the one that I've been looking at is really quite tersely written, very, very brief instructions.
Yeah.
A lot of it reads just like a list of ingredients, the names given, list of ingredients, some very basic cookery suggested, and then it tells you what colour the dish should look like. That's it. And you have to take that, I have to take that, and other people have to take that and turn it into something that's
That's how engine recipes are.
It's also badly punctuated, so it's actually quite difficult when you're looking at it in the, you know, in the manuscript. You think, why haven't they punctuated that list there? So sometimes items run in together, and you're thinking, what's this describing? Fortunately, somebody did an edition back in the 80s, 1986, of both of them, so you can look at that to help.
Yeah,
I do look at that to help me out, but also I like to be able to translate it for myself. My old French and Anglo-Norman is not the area I've specialised in, so I've had to improve my Anglo-Norman and old French in order to be able to understand it. But I can follow the manuscript, particularly the royal one is the one that's easy to access. The other one you have to actually go to the library, but the royal manuscript is available digitised, as I say, and I can. You know, the script's fairly easy for me to read. And as long as you get used to the abbreviations that are used, then it's quite easy to follow. And there are some recipes in there that don't really seem to carry on. The recipe that I'm working on the video, I'm not aware that it appears in later collections. It doesn't appear, for example, in Form of Curry. And it's a pistachio or pine nut tart, and it's set in a pastry made from chestnut flour.
Oh, okay.
And I'm not aware that there is another recipe for a chestnut pastry tart other than an English translation of the Anglo-Norman that's made just a few years later. It's a copy, a translation of the recipe, of the recipes into English, and it's the same dish, but I haven't seen the dish appear elsewhere, though I might yet discover something.
Okay, so what type of dishes or what ingredients were very popular then?
In this particular...
Yeah.
Well, let me read some of them through to you. I'll do it in English, not in Anglo-Norman. You don't want to hear my Anglo-Norman.
It will sound fine to me. I don't know any Anglo-Norman.
Let me just have a look. So if we look at the one I mentioned, the Royal Manuscript. It starts off with something called white Syrian food, and that's a kind of porridge made with almond milk and rice flour, and you add capon meat and ginger and sugar and a bit of wine. And that is something that is copied in later manuscripts. We get various Arabic influenced dishes that are this sort of porridge type dish,
yeah,
made with rice or rice flour, and then you add capon or chicken meat to it, and it's sweetened. I quite like it. The thought to a lot of people of eating sweetened chicken, they find that difficult.
I think it's a thought, isn't it?
Yeah, it's actually quite nice. Surprising that it works.
But presumably the rice was quite expensive back then?
Well, it would have been imported probably from Italy. It would have been relatively expensive, though not as expensive, say, for example, as the spices which come from further afield and sugar and that kind of
thing. And sugar will be even more expensive. So the food.
But I don't know the prices of. I've not researched that. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there are records of rice being imported somewhere that I will discover. But yeah, so that would have been ground though into flour. Wow. There is a recipe. Not in this collection, but in Form of Curry, where whole rice is used.
Mm.
It's just basically a kind of saffron risotto type thing. But a lot of the dishes in this Anglo-Norman collection and later collections involve rice flour, because it's used as a thickening agent as well, and it's used to create this sort of kind of porridge / slurry thick thing, which sounds wonderful, doesn't it, when I use that. You've then got the same dish. The next dish is basically the same, but it's green, and they colour it with parsley.
Right.
So it's almost exactly the same. And then you've got a yellow version, and that's coloured with saffron.
Yay.
And so these are all called Syrian food. I'm trying to think what the... Let me just check back in the... See what the original language was.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Yeah, so the word that's used is a kind of corruption of the French of Syria. So the word is désiré. So blanc de Syrie, that's white, food of Syria, vert de Syrie, green, and then there's agne Syrie, which is the yellow one.
Right.
So there you go. And then they claim to have something called Spanish food, which is another one of these rice flour dishes, and that's just got pistachios ground up and put on the top, and it's seasoned with cloves.
Right.
Which the recipe says the cloves actually enhance the flavour of pistachio nuts. That's quite interesting because I put some cloves in my recipe, my pistachio tart recipe that's going to appear in a video. There are some cloves in there.
Ooh, how intriguing.
Yeah. And then there's a mulled wine drink thickened with egg, various stews, and let's have a look how it continues. Various pottages. Again, a lot of these are rice flour or wheat starch based. So you've got them, and they're flavoured with things like hazelnuts, like fried hazelnut kernels, hawthorn blossom, roses, and strawberries or cherries. So there's a whole series of these types of thick pottages using ingredients that were most definitely available in England, you know, that were native things. There's a sweetened apple dish, which is quite interesting, which is kind of wine and eggs and some very fine wheat flour, it says. And then you dice up the apples and they're set on the top of this kind of thick custardy thing. And then you sprinkle, you have to add a bit of sugar to balance the wine, it says, which is an interesting expression, which confirms to us that when sugar is used in a lot of recipes, it's not about making it absolutely sweet, you know, the way we might think of very sweet puddings today.
Yeah.
But it's about as a counterpoint to something else. So they'll use sugar as a counterpoint to, as it says here, the strength of the wine. So the wine's probably quite vinegary. And so they're sweetening the wine a little bit. And sometimes it's used to balance out a spice, such as ginger. So in the hazelnut pottage, they use sugar to balance the bitterness, it says, of the ginger.
Mm.
And the same with the hawthorn pottage as well. So they're using all these imported spices. And then it goes on, there's several broths in there. One of them supposedly a German broth, which has got cloves, cubebs, and fried onions along with almond milk. And then it says that it should be hotly spiced with the cloves and cubebs, which is a bit scary because I find too many cloves and can be like, it's like medicine, isn't it? It's like going to the dentist. You get that sort of dental, astringent flavor coming through.
Yeah.
So there's things like that. And then there's this tart that I'm going to do, which is like using pistachios in a toffee.
Mm.
They're also, and that recipe is quite interesting, as I'll explain in my video, because it uses an ingredient called gingembre, or gingerbread translated, which is more like a toffee.
Right.
That was something that was elite households bought as a pre-made confection. So that goes into this mix. And there's several other, there's a jelly dish and some braised fish. And various other bits. So that gives you a good idea, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The kind of things that were going on then. And I think what I personally feel that as you get into, I mean, there's only like 32 recipes in this collection, but as you move towards form of curry, you get a more variety of things. Some of those dishes survive or get adapted. And then there's more emphasis, I think, in form of curry on roasted meats and more fish dishes as well.
It's fascinating, you know. I mean, all these foods, yeah, all these recipes, they do sound quite different. And there's an element of familiarity as well with the ingredients themselves. But the recipe, yeah, it's things that we wouldn't normally do it this way nowadays or in the last 100 years or so. And it's a really interesting challenge to actually bring these recipes to the forefront today and try and make them interpret what the people ate back then, but also make it palatable for us today. And
yeah, I suppose it depends what you want to do. I mean, there are some people that just want to replicate as closely as possible, you know, what they think was eaten. And so they'll try and produce something as authentic, as it were, as possible. And then there are people like me that kind of, yeah, I don't mind that idea, but you know, I also want to enjoy the food. And I'm not saying you can't enjoy these foods, but there are ways through experimenting where you inevitably end up drawing upon your own heritage, your own food heritage, your own cultural heritage, and you will. And I find myself introducing techniques that I've learned in modern cookery and applying those to medieval cookery.
Mm.
Plus, it works the other way around as well. Sometimes there are things in medieval cookery, the way things are done, and you think, oh, that's worth doing in dishes today. I mean, it's a small thing, but I quite like the idea of parboiling onions before you actually then fry them. In something that's quite nice. It also means if you parboiled them in a sort of some stock,
yeah,
or broth, as they would make, they would have had things like capon broth and beef broth. But if you parboil the onion in that, it flavors that broth, and you can use that in something. So there are little things that I think can be adapted. I think I said before in the last time we interviewed you. Generally speaking, I think pastry's improved since the medieval period. I think we make pastry better now than they did, because with the introduction of animal fats like lard and wood butter, which they didn't use back then.
Yeah.
Although their use of eggs and egg yolks in a pastry dough, I find that's quite interesting. It does provide you with more robust pastry,
yeah,
than you get with, say, a short crust. And so that can have its own advantages if you want something that's quite a sturdy pastry.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, sometimes they were using the pastry as a container for, you know, as it were, to cook the food in.
Yeah.
And other times they were eating it as well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And yeah, I guess, I mean, we still use egg yolks to finish our pastries anyway. So yeah,
we do, but normally it's in addition to butter.
Yeah,
of
course.
Or something like that.
Of course.
Whereas they didn't use butter in pastry. It works both ways. Sometimes I learn from reading medieval recipes, little techniques that I can find. But a lot of the time, they're not gone into in great detail. There's a certain level of knowledge already expected of you when you're looking at these recipes, generally speaking. And in the case of the Anglo-Norman ones, they hardly ever give any real detail. And then you might tell you to boil something together and that's about it.
Oh, yeah,
you've got to work the rest out for yourself.
I mean, if I read you a recipe from, it's not a recipe per se, but it's from Athenaeus quoting Archestratus, basically, and it says, "We must speak of the conger eel. Archestratus in his gastronomy relates where each part of it ought to be purchased, the conger. You have the head of the conger, friend, in Sicyon, a fat and strong and large head, and all the belly parts. Then boil it for a long time in salt water, sprinkle it with green herbs."
Right.
I mean, okay. And that's about it as for a recipe or for instruction.
Doesn't even tell you which herbs.
Yeah, yeah. It's up to you.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's very difficult to interpret certain things, isn't it?
I think so. I mean, I was thinking about when you compare, say, that and then sort of medieval English stuff, the earlier medieval English collections that survived, and then compare that with, say, the Italian Bartolomeo, I think that's how you say it, Bartolomeo Scappi.
Yeah.
I think it's Scappi, or is it Schappi? I'm terrible. I don't know any Italian, I'm afraid. So he wrote something in 1570, and I think his recipes, though they still confuse me, they are more detailed. There's more detail, and it's a huge work as well. And so you do kind of generally see a progression.
Yeah.
As the centuries go by, as you move out of the medieval period, you are leaving behind less detailed recipes, although towards the end of the medieval period, they are beginning to become more detailed. And then you arrive with someone like Scappi, and the detail is quite good.
Yeah.
It's quite helpful.
Do you think that's fascinating? Because do you think that's because of the evolution of technology, which obviously, you know, goes into the kitchen as well, but also the evolution of the different classes and how the system, the different working classes and the merchant classes, they evolve and they become more rich in a way, more wealthy. So they have the option to get all these ingredients, and they get cheaper the ingredients as well. And then, so everybody wants to be fashionable and cook all this food. So you need to know how to cook. You don't rely on cooks and chefs. So you have to do it yourself or whatever.
I'm not sure, to be honest. It's not something that I could offer anything that's well researched.
Yeah,
I would say with someone like Scappi, what I find interesting about him is there are illustrations that I believe he himself produced, and they appear on plates. And copper plates, I think. And you can, in the edition that's available in English, that's been translated by Terence Scully, those drawings are replicated. And you talked about technology. And what is interesting about Scappi is you've got all of the items that were in his kitchen being drawn, lots of examples. And so I think he becomes someone that maybe makes cookery more of a technology.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
Is he wanting to pass on his knowledge of cookery? And that's why you've got these things recorded, drawn, and so forth, and use this and use that, and put it in this kind of container. Whereas the medieval stuff, like the Anglo-Norman stuff, you know, you basically must already know how to cook for sure, and they're kind of just reminders of ingredients really that go into things. I think something like form of curry is a bit in between. There are some recipes that have some detail. There is some of the more difficult recipes go into measurements even. So there's a recipe for doing like mini castles, and it tells you how big the turrets are. It's a very, very confusing recipe, actually, I will say. So they're saying it was something that would have been used as quite a spectacular dish because it was a set alight. So they had some kind of spirit, probably a kind of brandy that was, or an eau de vie or something that was set alight. And so you bring them the castle and they would have all these flames. And that would have been brought to the table, probably just straight to the king's table. But for saying it was such a spectacular dish, it's not that well written. It's a bit confusing. It takes some working out. The cook that produced that could have done a better job, I think, in making it clearer. But yes, there are some detailed recipes, more detailed recipes in form of curry. And then in the 15th century, you get other collections that have quite detailed recipes. You still get recipes that are basically almost, you know, you can't work out what's being told because sometimes it's a copying thing. It's how, you know, a recipe's been butchered, as it were, over the decades as it's gone by, and it's kind of makes no sense anymore. But for some reason, the scribe decides it should still be recorded. You get that happening. And but I think, you know, I don't know enough about early modern recipes collections in England or the Renaissance collections. I don't know enough to, but I do know that they tend to be more detailed and more helpful. And of course, as you move into 17th, 18th, 19th century, you get a bit more information. And certainly the 20th century is when things really started to be, you know, it was really then, wasn't it, about telling basic folk how they can cook.
Yeah.
More elegantly.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of Fanny Craddock.
Yeah, exactly.
That kind of thing.
Fair enough.
We're being instructed, you know, and when I went to school back in the 70s, you know, and I did my home economics O-level, you know, it was, you know, you did learn the basic stuff, you know, baking and various cooking techniques that maybe were things that were passed down to in previous generations too. By mothers, and instead we were learning it at school.
That's cool. Yeah, yeah. How interesting. Yeah, we didn't do any home economics at school. I think it was all. Yeah.
That's my claim to being. That's my main training. My O level. I did. 2 or 3 years of cookery. I've never done any professional cookery, and I keep thinking one day I might actually do something and do some professional courses.
Right. Yeah, it's another challenge, another thing to do. It takes time. Yeah, in terms of foods, of easy medieval foods and sweets and so on, obviously you're trying to make the recipes easy for us, for the modern cook.
I do think, for me, it's important that I don't overcomplicate a recipe. And if it's possible to simplify it, I will do. I don't necessarily want to do that all the time. Sometimes, you know, the original recipe is doable. You know, even if you don't have a medieval kitchen, it's doable. You know, you can adapt things. You don't have to use spits and so forth. You can use an oven or whatever, or even a barbecue. But there are things that I will do, like I did in a series called called Easy Medieval Food, and in that I often adapted the recipes to make them simpler. So for example, instead of cooking a whole chicken, I decided to do the dish as chicken portions. I think it was more accessible that way. And so there's those kind of things that I might do. And also I did a dish which in some ways it would have been nice to have followed the recipe and had and made some comfits, the little sugar-coated seeds, and put those on this pudding dish. It didn't tell you in the recipe to make them. It just said put comfits on in the dish. And so I suppose somebody else in the medieval kitchen would have been working away doing that, spending the whole day producing these comfits, because they take forever to make, don't they? Because they've got sort of dozens of layers of sugar on them. So I just simplified it and thought, well, I'll take the spice that's going in there, which was coriander, and instead of coating coriander seeds in sugar, I'll just grind coriander and sugar and sprinkle that on top of the dish. And I thought that was much easier, and the flavor was still there. I still had the same flavor profile. So I try to do that as much as possible. So yeah, I think it's simplifying is important. The video that I'm just editing at the moment, the one I mentioned about pistachio tart and the gingerbread, when I originally did this, one of my first videos, I made it with pine nuts instead of the pistachios because there's the option in the recipe.
Yeah.
And I made my own gingerbread because I found a medieval recipe from a medical collection for making gingerbread. So I made that, my own toffee, and then added it to the filling. And I thought, this is a bit faffy, really, and I think people don't necessarily want to go to that trouble. So I just worked out a way of creating the same kind of toffee filling with the pistachios without having to make the gingerbread this time. So in a way, it was probably being more faithful to the recipe, because I don't think the cook's being told to make the gingerbread first. They're actually using the stuff that they bought in, you know, because this was it was bought in boxes. You'd get boxes of gingerbread that elite households would buy with their spices. And then someone obviously decided, oh, I'll use some of this gingerbread to make a nice toffee filling for these tarts. And so that's kind of what I'm doing. I'm sort of simplifying it, really, but in a slightly different way. So, yeah, it is important for me, I think, to make things as simple as possible, though I probably will attempt something complicated one day. I keep thinking I might do a cockatrice where you sew a cockerel and the front of a cockerel and the back of a piglet.
Piglet, yeah.
And vice versa, and you make this stuffing for them and then you sew it up.
Yeah, Jesus.
You're supposed to spit roast that. That's going to be difficult doing that on the barbecue, but, you know.
Yeah.
I might do that one day.
Yeah. What a recipe. Great. Okay, fantastic.
So maybe I could just ask you one question then.
Go on, yeah.
So when you've been looking at European medieval food, is there anything that stood out to you that really appeals to you? Is there a dish or a type of cooking that's appealed to you?
Mm. Yeah, let me answer this question. That's a very interesting question. Because,
this is called turning the tables on the interviewer, isn't it? you're not supposed to let the interviewee take over, but I've got my... I've got to get back at you somehow.
Yeah. Well, I mean, because I was trying to find out mostly the similarities between the different cuisines. So I was basically struck with the similarities of some dishes, like the potages. So there's a lot of potages and broths and stews. And of course, this is something that struck. And then not a specific dish, but obviously the other thing was the use of spices, which was a lot more prominent in early European, in medieval European cuisine. Yeah, there was a lot of spice, man. There's a lot of pepper, a lot of cumin pepper, a lot of ginger.
And it's still today, we don't... Of course, we're talking about elite food, you know, and we're not talking about peasant farmers would have cooked. They may have had access to some spices, perhaps in continental Europe, they may have had, you know, for example, access to saffron. And I don't know enough about like Spain and Italy on what spices, if there are any of the kind of spices that they were able to cultivate, or whether they, I think, were still importing the stuff as well. Saffron's the one thing, because I mean, we grew in England, saffron was great, but so, it was still imported as well. But generally, this is elite cuisine, isn't it? And today in England, I don't know about other parts of Europe, but spices, you know, they're not used that much, unless you're talking about Indian food.
Yeah, it's exactly that. Yeah, it's not as used as... you have certain spices like cinnamon and cloves, and which are used in a more Christmassy kind of thing, but not, yeah, baking and Christmassy thing, but not in everyday cuisine. And yeah, I think that, coriander, pine nuts, there was all the stuff used in abundance, pistachios, almonds.
So did you like the idea of the use of spices and quite a big range of spices in savoury foods as well?
Yeah. I think I've done so. Well, yeah, in the weeks that followed or during my research for the medieval food, I was cooking obviously at home, and I was just putting plenty of spices on my everyday kind of stews, or, you know, I was making things with chickpeas or beans or sauces, and I was just putting like coriander and cinnamon and cumin in abundance. Yeah. I was like, yeah.
Yeah, and you can, I think I can't speak for non-British people, but I think British people, when it comes to cooking, when they're cooking with spices at home today, they shy away from using too much.
Mm.
They're scared of using, or there are certain spices that, you know, you can accidentally use too much of, like cloves, for example, can completely ruin a dish if you, like we said earlier, if you use too many. But yeah, there's a shyness when it comes to saffron. You know, there's this idea that, you know, two strands of saffron will are enough, and then it's never enough. You can with certain dishes, you can use quite a lot of saffron, and it actually doesn't spoil the dish.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think one of the things that I think I've learned from doing medieval cookery is to be more adventurous and bold with spices. And, you know, it is about tasting things and testing things. But, yeah, I think that's something that you can take away from medieval European food and medieval English food, that, you know, spices can spice up your life.
Yeah.
Don't be afraid to have a go.
Don't be afraid of spices, absolutely.
Buy whole spices, generally, I'd say. Buy whole spices and grind them yourself if you can. I mean, you can't always do that. And
yeah.
I don't always do it myself, but that does make a difference, using like whole coriander seeds rather than ground coriander.
Yeah, absolutely. And then I think one last thing is the use of almonds and almond milk and almond flour.
Yeah.
Like almond milk especially, there was so many recipes that you find.
Yeah.
Which is, I guess...
Yes, it is. It is interesting. How much almond milk, because it was used as a substitute for broth, really.
Mm.
Or sometimes milk itself. Yeah, there's more almond milk appears in form of curry than cow's milk. It isn't always about religion either, because I mean, obviously it's important in fasting food. The lean days, as it were, when you're they call them fish days in English. And they use almond milk instead of a broth, like a meat broth or a capon broth in a dish. And but that isn't always the case. I think it became a quite ubiquitous ingredient in a lot of things, where you just use almond milk. Sometimes, I make my own almond milk, and it is quite a nice thing to do. It's much better than it's got more flavour than, you know, stuff that you buy in a carton, and it's not really the same thing. More almonds in almond milk that you make, you know, medieval almond milk, than there is in your cart, which has probably got 1 or 2% almonds.
Really? I never bought almond milk, to be honest. I don't know. So do you have a video on how to make your own almond milk on your channel?
I've not done a video. It did appear on one of my printed recipes that I did for my monthly subscribers, so it wasn't made generally available. But to be honest, I adapted, not quite copied exactly, I adapted the almond milk recipe from someone called Lorna Sass, who was an academic that wrote a book about Richard II's food.
All right, okay.
And she did it back in the 70s, and I managed to get a copy of it, and I really liked her recipe. It was quite straightforward. So are you saying that I've got to do a video then of how to make almond milk? Maybe I should stick that on my YouTube and on my website so that people can always refer to it.
If it's tastier than so bought, and if it's easy enough, and if it's used to as a broth, as a substitute broth, so it's very ubiquitous in use, then I think...
I'll probably have to say, I'm going to say try and use organic almonds because of the problem is with almond production, particularly in California, is it's wrecking the environment, isn't it? Because these massive almond tree farms where it's just a monoculture.
Yeah.
Whereas if you can get organic ones, they are a bit more expensive, but the Italians do nice almonds.
Mm.
And I try and get them whenever I can, because I don't really want to encourage people to kind of contribute to environmental
degradation, collapse, yeah.
which is what is going to happen is happening in those monocultures in California.
All right. Okay. Brilliant. Great. Thank you so much, Chris, for all your time and information here. And looking forward to seeing your book published at some point in the near future.
Yeah. And thank you for having me. I really enjoyed chatting to you.
Brilliant. Have a good night and talk to you soon.
Yeah. Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, that was very exciting. Thanks for listening, and thanks to my guest, Dr. Christopher Monk, for all his amazing knowledge about medieval English cuisine and the recipes from the form of curry. Now stay tuned for the extra content exclusive for Patreon backers. If you enjoyed this episode, please go to Patreon and subscribe there, where for $3 a month, you can get the podcasts early and ad-free, plus with extra bonus content. Additionally, you'll find a lot of my recipes and interpretations of ancient recipes by me, cooked either on the barbecue or in the kitchen, and a lot of other of my own archaeogastronomical musings, writings, and thoughts. It will help immensely produce this podcast more often with more interesting content and interviewing amazing guests, such as today's one. Thanks for listening. I've been Thomas Dinas, and this was the Delicious Legacy Podcast.
Catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.